from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive, just off Veterans Parkway in Washington in Bloomington, serving Bloomington Normal and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. A grand opening taste testing day will be held Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222.
Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We're going to get underway this afternoon in this portion of the program with the opening of a spiritual, Been in the Storm So Long. It's sung by Bernice Johnson.
I've been in the storm so long. I've been in the storm so long, children. I've been
Been in the Storm So Long, sung by Bernice Johnson. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and our guest this afternoon is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch. His latest book is At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68. He begins his latest book by telling readers the whole architecture of representative democracy springs from the handiwork of nonviolence. The book begins with the Selma to Montgomery marches and Lyndon Johnson's call to the nation to strike down voting restrictions. Taylor Branch also tells the story of the effort to bring the fight for civil rights north. He looks at the call by some to abandon the strategy of nonviolence, as well as King's opposition to the war in Vietnam. The book ends with King's assassination in Memphis, where, in a speech the day before, he said there would be difficult days ahead, that he might not reach the promised land, but that he had seen it. Listeners, I invite your questions about America in the King Years for our guest, Taylor Branch. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're not in the Champaign-Urbana area, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68, follows Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963 to 65, and Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 63. The publisher, Simon Ann Schuster. Taylor Branch, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. Nice to be with you.
The idea that you begin this book with is where I would like to begin this afternoon. The idea that, as I quoted you just a moment ago, that the whole architecture of representative democracy springs from the handiwork of nonviolence. Yet you also say nonviolence is an orphan among democratic ideals. A couple of questions here. What would you like to say about the power of nonviolence, and why is it an orphan?
Well, I think therein lies the riddle of our politics today and why we're dissociated from our history in many respects. I place nonviolence at the heart of democracy for two main reasons. Number one, almost by definition, the raw ingredient of democracy and representative democracy is a vote, and every ballot is nothing more than a piece of nonviolence. It's an institutionalized commitment of citizens to settle political disputes by votes and nonviolent methods in place of our inherited tendency to conquest. In that sense, democracy itself is nothing than a very sophisticated system of anger management and of consent between citizens. It takes a long time to build. The second way, so in a way, nonviolence is at the heart of democracy by definition. psychologically, the founding fathers identified the real obstacles. What made democracy a laughingstock to most of the ancient world was the pretty historical consensus that most people needed external discipline, couldn't govern themselves, and they needed a king or some authority, or a dictator, or an army, or some authority structure to keep them in line. The idea that they could govern themselves was considered ridiculous. The founding fathers said, in Madison's word, "We rest all of our political experiments on the capacity of mankind for self-government." That means individually and collectively that people can restrain themselves, that they can look at the other side of the picture, and at the same time they can develop public trust in their fellow citizens, which does not come naturally. It goes against the grain of human nature, which is to, you know, trust yourself and want to govern the other guy. So the civil rights movement and nonviolent demonstrators who were willing to and train themselves in self-restraint, to accept blows in a cause, to go to jail, to be beaten, to look their oppressors in the eye and always maintain the hope of establishing a new civic bond, are really kind of shock troops of the democratic attitudes of self-government and faith in strangers. And I think that's why they had such an enormous political impact in the 1960s when they were trying to democratize the United States at a time of segregation.
Hmm. How did King come to nonviolence, and how was he able to remain in the storm so long?
That's a good question. I loved your hymn. Bernice Johnson Reagan, I met in the Albany, studying the Albany movement. She comes out of Albany, Georgia, which is a major movement early in Dr. King's career, 1961. That song is also the title of a wonderful book about Reconstruction by Leon Litwack. That's in my bibliography, so it meant a lot to me that you started that way. Dr. King got to nonviolence by several converging paths. Of course, the first is that he was a preacher, and nonviolence is at the heart of Christianity of love, loving your enemies. Loving your enemies is more or less at the heart of what makes Jesus a significant and lasting prophetic figure, quite apart from salvation. His teachings, nonviolence, are really at the heart of them. Loving your brothers, treating the least of these, forgiving 70 times 7, the whole Christian ethic is about forgiveness and loving one's enemies. And Dr. King only lamented the fact that so many conventionally religious people gave up that ethic so easily. And as he said wryly, that Christians tend to oppose all wars except the one we're in. So that was one. He also studied Gandhi and a number of other factors. But when he got back after the bus boycott, having been propelled into the leadership of the early civil rights movement, he knew that the civil rights movement here was different in many respects from the demographics that Gandhi faced, where he, 95% of the population was Indian against a tiny colonial elite. Here, there was a tiny black segregated population without access to traditional political tools of much money or mass media or certainly armies or any of that sort of thing. And so political necessity, religious training, and improvisation, and his own immersion of black people in the ideology of freedom and the story of freedom kind of forged a new brand of nonviolence that he remained unbelievably steady in support. Basically what I call equal souls and equal votes. He put one foot in the scripture and the other foot in the Constitution and our patriotic documents.
Mm. How did King respond to those who questioned nonviolence as a strategy?
He said nothing else is practical and nothing else goes to the heart of both our civic and our spiritual faith. And therefore, it was not only right, but it was practical. And in that sense, it made it very poignant for me. And I will say this. I worked 24 years on this, and I didn't anticipate how much he would emphasize nonviolence toward the end of his life. Almost as everyone else was rejecting it across the political spectrum, the people who wanted to make war in Vietnam, the people who wanted to take up arms against the war in Vietnam, kind of all turned against nonviolence and said that it was passé. And Dr. King became increasingly lonely in the last couple of years of his life in saying that nonviolence has been the instrument for democracy and advancing our faith that's going to pay dividends, and it's a leadership doctrine, and we have to stick with it. But he became a pretty lonely voice.
Yeah. How was he able to maintain himself?
Well, I think it was because early on, back to the bus boycott, something just clicked very deep down inside him that nonviolent doctrines were the underpinnings of both democracy as a hope for America, for black Americans and for America at large, and for being true to the religious imperative in the world to redeem the world by suffering. And that message was so sturdy in Dr. King that it really is a striking feature of his oratory that his refrains were so balanced. He would have a spiritual citation for Isaiah or Jeremiah or Jesus and pair it with something from Jefferson or Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt or James Madison. And so, I think Dr. King developed a unique gift that he really needed because he was so battered from all sides during the movement years.
Hmm. The book begins in Selma, March 1965, and there would be three Selma to Montgomery marches, I guess you could say, two attempts, and then finally the third succeeded in getting to Montgomery. The first became known as Bloody Sunday. What happened?
March 7th, 1965, 600 black people. It was an all-black march of people, mostly from Selma and a few from the surrounding rural counties, set out over the Alabama River, the Pettus Bridge over the Alabama River from Selma, in an attempt to march 54 miles through the heart of desolate Klan country with a petition for the Governor George Wallace, to petition him for the right of black people to vote. Nearly all black people were denied the right to vote in that time. And just on the far side of the bridge, the lines were met by Alabama state troopers, by sheriff deputies, and by kind of deputized posse-men, mostly Klansmen on horseback, who charged into the nonviolent marchers and beat them back across the bridge with horses and clubs and tear gas and truncheons that had barbed wire wrapped around them, and sent 60-something of them into the hospital. And scenes of this charge appeared that night on television and really had a galvanizing effect on not just the United States but the whole world.
Yeah. What lay between Selma and Montgomery? Tell us about that 50-mile stretch of landscape.
Well, it was pretty rough. Most notably, the county between Selma, which is Dallas County, and Montgomery, which is Montgomery County, was called Lowndes County. And Lowndes County at that time was enormous, 700 square miles of cattle country. 70% of the population was black, and not a single one of them had been registered to vote in the entire 20th century. It really was a feudal area, and noted for its lynchings and noted for the fact that it just had a lot of very bizarre habits. One that struck me was the fact that nobody drank a certain kind of beer or smoked a certain kind of cigarettes because people remembered in the fog of some time that the companies that made those two brands may have made a contribution to the NAACP back in the past, and it was just considered a matter of white social expectancy that to uphold white supremacy that you wouldn't partake of those products. So it was a very, very dangerous and fearful place. And when they finally did march from Selma to Montgomery, two people were killed there. A housewife who came down, Viola Liuzzo, who came down from Detroit, was killed in Lowndes County. by Klansmen, and a seminarian from New Hampshire, Jonathan Daniels, who came down and actually stayed on for the march, was arrested in the very first demonstration ever in Lowndes County against segregation the following summer, which lasted about 1 minute. He was carted off in garbage trucks to jail and released a week later and shot down with a shotgun with a Catholic priest right outside the jail. So Lowndes County was a very tough area, and it's surprising to me, and I think will be to a lot of readers, that this kind of brutality existed in the name of white supremacy only 40 years ago.
Yeah. So whose idea was it? We got to walk through this territory. We've got to march from Selma to Montgomery. Why did they make that decision? It's so dangerous.
Well, they had gone. The very brief backdrop where the previous volume ends was Dr. King got the Nobel Peace Prize at the end of 1964 after the 10-year struggle against legal segregation was successful in the 1964 Civil Rights Act. When they went to the Nobel Prize ceremonies in December 1964, most of Dr. King's staff wanted to celebrate the Nobel Prize and the end of segregation for a decade or two of chicken dinners and awards, but Dr. King had been pestered by two of his young staff people, James Bevel and Diane Nash, of Chicago. In fact, this book is dedicated to Diane. She and her husband Bevel had been tormented by the Birmingham church bombing in 1963 because they had been responsible for and advocated using small children in demonstrations, which was a very controversial decision. And they felt all the more stricken that children, four girls were killed in the bombing out of that same church that the marches had occurred in Birmingham. They stayed up all night and wrote a plan to answer the heinous crime against the four little girls by trying to paralyze Alabama until it gave black people the right to vote. So it had been their idea, and Diane took this plan to Dr. King and basically pestered him with it all through the year. And at the Nobel Peace Prize, Dr. King said, we can't stay here on the mountaintop. This is nice to receive awards, but there are people who can't vote. We have to go back to the valley from the mountaintop. And he went straight to Selma, very much against the wishes of a lot of his grumbling aides, on this plan that was devised by these two young people, Bevel and Nash. And they demonstrated in Selma for almost 2 months, and there was a lot of repression, a lot of jail going, a lot of suffering. And one young man was finally killed. And in response to this, James Bevel, Diane Nash's husband, proposed more or less extemporaneously that that everybody march all the way to Montgomery as a gesture, a desperate effort to draw national attention, to do a 50-mile march through Klan country with a petition to answer the death of this young man, Jimmie Lee Jackson, with a new law to give people the right to vote. So it was a desperate measure, but as it turned out, it worked really well because, as always, violence backfired. And as Dr. King said, long-term power in a democracy grows against the grain of violence, not with it. And as had happened in Birmingham in 1963 when dogs and fire hoses were loosed on small children in the demonstrations there. It happened again in Selma that when the Klansmen were violent, the country and the whole world really kind of rose up against the grain of violence and ended segregation in the first case and established the right of black people to vote in the second one. And that's kind of the very, very complicated but uplifting political story that begins this volume.
Yeah. And in March of 1965, we have Lyndon Johnson addressing Congress and the nation. An amazing speech. Tell us about it.
Yes, that was March 15th, only 8 days after Bloody Sunday. Eight amazing days of that galvanized the country. Dr. King put out a request that very night of Bloody Sunday, March 7th, asking people of goodwill, mostly clergy, not to write a letter to their congressman or elect a new president or send in a contribution, but he asked them to come right then. He said, come tomorrow and stand with these people who've been beaten, and they did by the hundreds and thousands, and it mobilized the Great Citizens Movement. And behind the scenes, Dr. King is negotiating with all three branches of the U.S. government and with a converging movement about what to do. And part of that was talking to Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States, and we're able to follow that, ironically, because of the wiretaps that recorded the conversations on King's end and the telephone recordings that now enable us to listen to what Johnson was saying to his people and to King on the other end. And there was a remarkably subtle and inventive and skillful development of the politics where by Johnson, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, went before the Congress, proposed the Voting Rights Act, and at the in a remarkable speech that placed it right in the whole context of liberty, said, you know, there are certain moments that in which the meaning of a country meet events in a great trial. So it was at Lexington and Concord in the American Revolution. So it was at Appomattox. So it was also last week at Selma. And he called it a defining moment of American history, proposed the bill, and then said, we've got lots of problems, but we will overcome them. We shall overcome.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting that we're hearing an echo here in Johnson of what was grounding King, and that is faith, history, politics.
Absolutely. And they had a much stronger bond between them than people realized. Their cooperation was subtle. I was stunned to find in there, Johnson later said, you know, this was a historic cooperation because I couldn't have proposed this bill unless you created the citizens' movement that built the political space for me to do what I wanted to do in the first place. It wouldn't have been practical for me to do it without a citizens' movement that I couldn't endorse, I couldn't stir up. But basically, he said that there was a symbiosis and a cooperation between public opinion and a popular movement that moved public opinion and the duty of public officials to respond. Johnson and most people on all sides had no idea that King and Johnson shared this kind of commitment to the right to vote. Johnson even said that he wished the Brown decision about school desegregation in 1954 had been grounded in the right to vote rather than in the right to integrated schools because he thought it was more basic. He just said the right to vote is the most basic material in democracy. And we have to do that, even though he knew and said that it would cost Democratic presidents their base in the South in future elections, which has certainly proven to be true. The South went from being solid Democrats under segregation toward what we have today, where it's almost solid Republican. And there weren't Republican, there were hardly any Republicans in the South before that. So it was a pretty remarkable cooperation between King and Johnson. And certainly most of the Southern politicians were stunned to hear Johnson embraced the slogan of the civil rights movement. It was a jaw-dropping moment in American politics. His best friend Richard Russell, the senator from Georgia, said that no man has ever been more of a traitor because he thought Johnson was who had been a steady supporter of the White South and that he was throwing in his hand with the opposition. Of course, Johnson felt that he was finally having an opportunity to stand for democracy, and he saw it differently.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Taylor Branch. His latest book, At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965-68. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes. Is this line one?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm fascinated by the discussion, and I think I've seen you on C-SPAN, Mr. Branch. My question to you is, and I read this in some book that was a critique, not a severe critique, but a reality critique of Dr. King and his movement, is that it went very far in empowering African Americans in the apartheid South in terms of political and social rights, but it fell short, and the legacy still falls short of economic empowerment. Drawing an analogy between the freedom of South Africans in terms of following Nelson Mandela, economic empowerment still seems to be lacking for the lion's share of those individuals, whereby they seem to have political and social empowerment. Is that a fair critique of Dr. King's movement and Nelson Mandela's movement?
Yes, I think it is. But I think that it doesn't really amount to much more than saying history doesn't happen overnight. That, you know, political and social equality is something that most in South Africa is something that most people thought it would take nuclear Armageddon to get, didn't think that it would happen. Just as most people throughout the 20th century didn't really expect segregation to dissolve in the southern part of the United States. So, and even in the matter of economics, there's a lot more economic equality in the sense of a large black middle class in the United States in many, many professions to which they had been barred than there was imaginable beforehand. I mean, we have to remember that at the time Dr. King was killed, if he'd turned on the television, even the college basketball games would have been still segregated in 1968. That is, that all the college basketball players would have been white in his region of the country. So things were set in motion that have changed the country, as he put it, politically, socially, and economically, and not just for black people. It is kind of a sad irony. He predicted that the end of segregation would liberate the white South, and in that has certainly been true. And I think you're correct to emphasize the difference in economic rights, because the white South has been liberated economically, politically, and socially to a greater degree than black people. I mean, there was no Sun Belt when it was segregated. It was the poorest region of the country. It wasn't even fit for professional sports teams. And the mayor of Atlanta said, when they eliminated segregation, we built a sports stadium on land we didn't own, with money we didn't have, for a team we hadn't found. And the Atlanta Braves moved there. So the South basically has been liberated in many respects, as have women and other disadvantaged groups, socially, politically, and economically, from the forces set loose in the 1960s. But you're absolutely correct to say that economics is the one for black people where change is the slowest and most difficult. But we have to remember that for two generations since the 1960s, it has not really been on the political agenda to try to advance the economic interests of African American, of disadvantaged people. I mean, the prevailing political wisdom in America is that efforts to end poverty fail and are useless, and that government is impotent. And in that respect, we really haven't followed up much more on the efforts that the civil rights movement set in motion 40 years ago.
One last question. Why haven't we had another Dr. King, another messianic figure of his stature and his commitment since he died, unfortunately, on April 4, 1968?
Well, that's a good question. I think figures like that are rare. You know, I've come after all these years to see the movement and him as the representative of the movement as kind of a modern founding father, in the sense that the movement confronted subjugation and oppression, and just like Thomas Jefferson and Madison did, and tried to figure out ways to move toward equal citizenship. And figures that can do that and can frame things in a large patriotic and spiritual cause the way Dr. King did are quite rare. And in a way, the questions are really complicated because it also calls into question the relationship between the leader and the social movement. Did Dr. King create the movement, or did the movement create him? So some people say what we really need is a spark from thousands of people asking questions about how we can restore hope through our politics and through our government, and that will call forth a Dr. King in the sense of another patriotic and prophetic voice, whether it's a black preacher or an immigrant female politician. We don't know what the next Dr. King is going to look like.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Taylor Branch. He has just completed a trilogy of America in the King Years, the final book at Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 1968. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, so we look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. That caller raises a couple of interesting issues, and where I'd like to go next is to the economic issue and the movement moving north, for example, to Chicago, where the issues included jobs and segregation and redlining. What was the strategy in Chicago, and were there gains made?
Yes, that's a good question. First of all, there was an enormous debate within the movement over whether to go north. Some people felt that they should stay south, where the movement had a record of success, and consolidate gains. Basically, there were very few even registered voters, let alone elected officials or new jobs in a newly integrated South. But Dr. King felt that the movement was prophetic. That is, that it was a headlight showing the way of the future, and that the country was ready and needed to understand that the race issue was not sectional. It wasn't just a function of pot-bellied Southern sheriffs. That it had always been national. Slavery existed in most northern states, and segregation in slums were a trademark of oppression that he himself had experienced as a graduate student in Boston. So he felt that the nation needed to understand that the race issue was national, and that some of these economic legacies of segregation needed to be addressed if we were to have a healthy democracy. And they auditioned several northern cities, Boston, Philadelphia, even Rochester, New York, along with Chicago, and finally settled on Chicago with a lot of infighting and resistance within his movement. But he came in 1966 and lived in a slum on the west side of Chicago. Basically to prove that nonviolence could work in the north, that urban people could maintain nonviolence in demonstrations, to prove that there was a racial animosity in the North, and that the talk of slums weren't a natural creation, but to some degree were an artificial creation of politics and redlining. And in those goals, they succeeded magnificently, because there was tremendous violence against nonviolent protesters trying to march for the right of black people to own any homes or to rent in white neighborhoods. Their goal was very modest. They wanted 1% of the housing in the 70-something, 78 neighborhoods in Chicago to be occupied by minorities. But there was enormous resistance to that on the part of the white neighborhoods that they marched through. And Dr. King was hit with rocks, and there was a great deal of violence there.
Yeah, and Mayor Daley, Richard Daley, also was set against King, and you write about Daley going after King and the movement in a phone call to President Johnson in July of that year. And at this point, King had been speaking out against the war in Vietnam, so Daley really worked that button with Lyndon Johnson, didn't he?
Absolutely. Daley knew that. I mean, there's a lot of subtext there, because Johnson knew that Daley didn't support the Vietnam War either. Privately, he thought it was a terrible mistake. He thought it was going to ruin the Democratic Party. and he had tried to get Johnson not to go into Vietnam and to get out once he got there. At the same time, though, Daley was a professional politician who played by the rules. When you make an alliance with somebody, you're with them. And he told Johnson, we're with you, you know, by through thick and thin. That's not the way you do business. You know, we're going to stick with you. And all my aldermen are going to be with you, too. And he tried to isolate King and say, King is not with you. He hates you. He's a faker. And basically, Daley was only reinforcing a point that King had already appreciated in this subtle exchange between him and Johnson, that he knew that Johnson didn't want to be in Vietnam but had cast his lot there, and that Johnson felt that the rules of politics obliged all your friends to support you, and that in that sense, Daley was loyal and King was not, because King felt that Johnson was making a terrible mistake. And Daley, in talking to Johnson, was essentially cutting off King's line of appeal to the national government. And in that sense, the historic significance is that Chicago was the only movement that King ever took part in that was not framed as an appeal to the whole American people to vindicate American principles of equal citizenship through their government, through the national government. As he put it, you know, I have a dream that this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. He knew that Daley, that basically Vietnam and northern segregation, that there was no appeal to Johnson at that time in Chicago, that Daley had Johnson wrapped up. And so he framed Chicago as a local movement, a purely local struggle against neighborhood segregation and slums in Chicago, and reached the best agreement he could with Mayor Daley.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just want to thank Mr. Branch for his writings. A number of years ago, I read the first and second volume, and I'm looking forward to reading this third volume. But he is an excellent storyteller in print, as he is here on the radio. And there were a number of people brought to life in Volume 1 and Volume 2 that I would otherwise never have heard of, Diane Nash and Beeville and Congressman John Lewis, or he's now Congressman Lewis. And you know, the stories are just astounding. Another thing that stands out is the importance of this concept of the beloved community in the early civil rights days, and I believe it was the role of James Lawson in teaching that to the early activists. So I want to thank you for your life's work on this trilogy and look forward to reading your next volume. And if you do want to comment on the notion of the beloved community, I would love to hear you talk about that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you to the caller. And he mentioned people from the first two volumes, Diane Nash, of course, who this book is dedicated to, because essentially Selma was her idea, and John Lewis, who was leading the march at Selma, where the book opens, and Jim Lawson, the teacher of nonviolence in Nashville, ironically winds up leading the sanitation strike in Memphis where Dr. King was killed. So he's kind of the alpha and omega. He starts out teaching nonviolence in the 1950s to students and becomes Dr. King's friend, and then in a very poignant and painful moment, Lawson has to, at the end of this book, Lawson feels that the movement has failed Dr. King, and to some degree he's failed Dr. King, because nonviolence broke down in his city in the garbage strike when some of the people in a march started breaking windows. And broke down, meaning there was a lapse from it, and that was very sad. So these characters are run through here. They're not very well known, basically the remarkable fact about all this is that there are hundreds and thousands of ordinary citizens who become heroes by taking citizenship seriously, doing what Diane Nash said, which is that if we believe we're all equally responsible for what our country does, the first thing we have to do is act like it, and they were quite remarkable people. Now, the beloved community is really a religious phrasing of the democratic ideal of equal citizenship, a beloved community of people who kind of elevate public service and political spiritual trust, put it on a spiritual plane. And that is a concept that the nonviolent movement developed when they were trying to inculcate the discipline and the citizenship to bear witness for democracy and nonviolent demonstrations.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Taylor Branch. How was King's opposition to the war seen by the press? How was he treated in the press? This is an interesting thing, going back to, I'm thinking right now of an earlier episode where we're back following Selma, and King's on Meet the Press, and he's just brutalized.
Yes, the first question was, don't you think, Dr. King, that the march from Selma to Montgomery was silly?
Yeah.
Now, this is after a historic march that has changed the whole structure of partisan politics.
Yeah.
And that where people were risking their lives and actually martyred on the way. But to call it silly, this, like a lot of the things in the 60s, is so hot-button that the meanings are unclear and they point in all directions. The movement made, the media made the civil rights movement by publicizing
mm-hmm.
things like Bloody Sunday and those terrible marches, violence against the march. But the news media also really reacted viscerally against the movement at other times, like calling the Selma to Montgomery march silly. And we have to remember that the interpreting classes, the pundits, didn't know anything about the civil rights movement. They weren't part of it. They were excluded. They were comfortable with the politicians in Washington who were setting an agenda, and along comes a social movement of street citizens and people that would be mistaken for waiters who were setting an agenda, and, you know, young people are holding press conferences. And that was pretty alien to them, and so they were very susceptible to saying this was a troublesome and needless exercise. And in some respects, the notion that the people who led the media had been raised in politics of an earlier time that didn't have any black participation whatsoever. And so they were very susceptible toward what has become the kind of litany of political discourse ever since then, that this was a time of upheaval and meddlesome politics and license that didn't really accomplish anything good and proved that, you know, government is bad. And to that degree, it's distorted. The media have helped distort our interpretation of what happened then. I think history will say, and that's the reason you get resonance from the death of Rosa Parks, and that the 1960s, in the long run, democratized America across the board and in ways that nobody wants to renounce, but we tend to take mm-hmm. it for granted and don't celebrate or even study the remarkable political processes that produced this, because they were painful and alien to the people who regularly interpret politics.
Yeah. Well, back to King and his opposition to the war. How was that portrayed by the news media? And was there a conscious effort, do you think, or was this something that just happened, that there was a marginalization of King by the media because of his opposition to the war?
Well, it wasn't just the media. It was the culture across the board. When you mobilize for war, there's an itch behind war, and it's pretty hard to go against it. The civil rights movement is about overcoming fear and confronting and overcoming it and making friends where people had been estranged. War is about subduing people and cultivating a sense of who your enemy is. And so the two attitudes clashed, and the atmosphere of war poisoned the civil rights movement. And King's criticism of the war met resistance not just in the media, and certainly not just in Lyndon Johnson, who understood what King was saying, and to a much greater degree than has ever been acknowledged publicly, understood and sympathized with what King was saying. Johnson didn't want to make that war either, but he did it anyway and was committed. King was opposed by the leaders of the other civil rights groups. I mean, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the Urban League, said that this was a terrible mistake. They cultivated their own relations with the White House, said that this was undermining a historic alliance, that they shouldn't meddle in foreign policy. The media groups, including the ones that had been sympathetic to Dr. King, told him to stick to civil rights. They essentially segregated him and said he was a spokesperson only on black issues, but didn't have any business or expertise speaking on foreign policy, which wounded King because he said, you know, this is about citizenship. We can't segregate citizenship. And I won the Nobel Peace Prize trying to extend peace in the world. But the Washington Post, for example, said that Dr. King will never again be respected as a spokesperson of his people, for his people. So basically saying explicitly that they wanted to hear from King only on matters of race relations. So, and then, of course, the people who were for the Vietnam War and whipped up for the Vietnam War called King a traitor. So, yes, this is a very emotional...